We are in 2 Kings chapter 4 tonight. We will try to do 4, 5, and 6. We will see, right? So we ended chapter 3, and they were fighting against Moab, and this king offers his son on the wall, like a human sacrifice on the wall, and everybody's kind of like, oh, he went there and kind of left. That pretty much killed the battle, and they departed from that time, from that area. So chapter 4, we kind of have this indiscriminate amount of time between those events in chapter 3 and chapter 4, and we have a chapter heading here. What do you have for the chapter heading in chapter 4? What's that? The widow's oil, right? The widow's pot of oil. So we're going to talk about oil, which I'm sure, never mind. We're going to talk about oil. So, now a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. You know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor has come to take my two children to be his slaves." This woman cries out to Elisha. She is who again? The wife of sons of the prophets. Remember, we're going to talk a lot about these sons of the prophets. Sort of like a preaching school kind of situation where guys kind of come and learn underneath a prophet. And so here is somebody that he knew and probably knew or possibly knew this lady as well. And she's saying that she is now a widow, and that due to the credit situation that her sons are possibly going to be taken away. And so if you want to write out to the side there, Leviticus chapter 25, 39 and 41 talks about how they could be slaves. They were not to treat their own kin, as far as Israelites were not to treat slaves or people who are Israelites as, you know, they would other slaves. But they were also to be let free in the year of Jubilee. So there was only a certain amount of time that they could be serving in a house. If you also want to write there, Exodus 22 through 24, God says that you are not to afflict the widows or the orphans. He says, if you afflict the widows or the orphans, I will kill you. He was pretty strict, pretty severe about how you treated widows or orphans, which this lady right now is a widow and her sons are orphans. So here's a situation where they need to be careful how they're treating this lady. So obviously, Elisha takes those things into consideration. And what is his response to this woman? What does he tell her to do? Yeah, take some vessels. Go borrow some jars, right? You go find all the mason jars you can find. Is basically how we would update, right? Go find all the jars. Go find all the containers that you can possibly find and bring them to your house. Now, he's not saying, you know, just go find one or two. He's saying find as many as you physically possibly can. And he says, go into into the house, shut the door behind you. This doesn't need to be a big ordeal. I don't want everybody knowing about this, because if everybody knows about this, then what? Chaos. I got chaos, right? If you bring candy to school, you have to bring candy for everybody. So in this situation, you know, you don't want chaos. And so they go in, they shut the door, and begin filling up these pots from this other jar of oil, right? So he had asked her, when he asked her how to help her, he says, like, what do you have in the house? What do you have in the house that we can multiply here? What do you have in your house that we can help you with? And she says, a jar of oil. What kind of oil, we don't know. It could have been a spiced oil. Could have been doTERRA. They sell it later on, so it's pretty expensive. So we don't know what kind of oil it is. So in this situation, they fill up these vessels. And then the mom says, bring me another vessel. So she's pouring it, and what do her sons say? There ain't any more. We filled them all up. I just imagine this house being full of vessels, you know, all over the place, filled up with oil. And so at this point, the oil stops. And what is the instruction that Elisha gives her? I've done that. Now what do I do with it? Sell it. Sell this stuff. It's apparently expensive enough for them to pay off their debts and for them to live on for a while. So it's probably more than just olive oil. It's probably some sort of spiced oil or some sort of anointing oil that would have been more expensive. And so, anyway, so they're into money at this point. And so here we have one of the situations where Elisha helps this lady. And we're going to be seeing a series of events with Elisha And this kind of highlights some miracles that Elisha does. And then we come into a section of Scripture with the Shunammite woman. And I'm going to just put these up here for us tonight. Hopefully we'll get to these. Maybe. Okay. So we have the Shunammite woman, or Shunammite son that is healed. And in verse 8, they come. Elisha is passed over to Shunem. Let me give you a map. I think I have a map. There it is. Can y'all see that? Some of you? So Shunem's right here. Can y'all see the bouncy ball? Okay, here's Shunem. This is Mount Carmel right here. Dothan right here is also important. He spends a lot of time in Dothan and a lot of time in Mount Carmel. This is the area he would travel to go back and forth because it's like mountains right here. So what's in the middle right there that he passes by? Shunem. So we're going to talk about why Shunem is something that's important in relationship to this. So he's traveling through Shunem quite a bit. And now it is part of the tribe of Issachar. And when we talk about the Shunammite, we're talking about somebody who is an Israelite. We're not talking about some random tribe of Shunem. We're talking about people who are in the brotherhood, so to speak. And so there's a prominent woman there. And what does she do as he's coming through and traveling through? What does she do? She feeds him. She says, hey, come on in here, eat here. I want to take care of you. And this happens for a period of time, so much so that she convinces her husband, hey, let's build a small place for him. And not just any place, but apparently she says, behold, I perceive that this is a holy man of God passing by us continually. Let's make a walled upper chamber and let him set a bed there and a table and a chair and a lampstand. And so he can stay here whenever he's kind of going in between places, right? So she's wanting to take care of this man of God. Not only just take care of him, she went above and beyond what's socially required of her in preparing this place for him, a place that would be just his whenever he's traveling through. Now it comes after they've been there a while, they come in there, And Elisha is saying, hey, call this Shunammite, which, by the way, through this whole story, he just calls her Shunammite. We don't ever have a name for this lady. So apparently Elisha wasn't on a first name basis with people. So he says, call this Shunammite. And when he had called her, he stood before her and said, say to her. So this is kind of a weird interaction. So he's talking to her through Gehazi. He said, say to her, how can we, what do you want us to do for you because you've done this for us? Do you want a good word with the king? Do you want a good word with the commander of the army, which is number one and number two in the nation? That's like, do you want a good word with the president or vice president? It'd be that kind of thing. And she's like, nope, I'm content with my people, with where I am. I don't need to be fed at the king's table as some have been in the past, as we've read that in 1 Kings. And so she's content with that. But Gehazi says what? What does she not have? A son. In that time, it was sort of a reproach to be a woman who did not bear any children. And he says, well, by this time next season, you will embrace a child. And what is her response to that? What does she say? Oh, thanks. Appreciate it. That's awesome. What does she say? Don't lie to me. Don't tease me. Don't tempt me with something that I have longed for so long. Don't tempt me with this. Know, my Lord, O man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. And so, verse 17, the woman conceived and bore a son that season. And the next year, Elisha said to her. And so, it did happen, obviously. Elisha says it, or the Lord says it, and it happens. Now, what happens to the son? You may have a heading there. He dies, which the mortality rate in that time period is probably higher, right? We probably imagine that the mortality rate for children was higher than it is now. As you read the text, the child goes out into the field with the father. The child is at this time old enough to do that, so as young as 4 and 5 years old. We have no idea how old this child is. It goes out into the field with the father and says to the father, my head, and falls ill, goes to the mother, and by noon, the child has died in the mother's arms. So, not a happy scene. Here's a lady who has been waiting for a child for so long, finally has a child, and at a young age dies in her arms. Could have been, there's so many things that could have been, heat stroke, aneurysm. We have no idea what it was, but the child dies. And what does she do with the body? Laid it on not just anybody's bed. Didn't put him on like his bed, which was probably like a race car red bed. Didn't put it on that, on his bed. Where did he put it? On Elisha's bed. I've heard this somewhere before. What happened with Elijah? Did Elijah not raise somebody from the dead? Is it in 1 Kings chapter 17, 17 to 24, it's possible this woman knows that Elijah had done this before. And so it's possible that it could happen with her child as well. What's interesting is we don't read about her grieving yet. We don't read about her grieving. Well, what does she do? She lays the child on the bed, and shuts the door, goes down, calls her husband, says, "Let me have one of the servants and a donkey, and then I can go to the man of God so I can return with him." And he says, "It's not new moon or Sabbath. It's not the normal time you should be going." He's not, maybe he doesn't think the child died. He doesn't know that information yet. Maybe she's kept it from him. Or maybe, we don't know why he's not even thinking about that. Some of you ladies are probably thinking, "Well, I know where he's not thinking about it." But he's not thinking about that. And in this situation, he's like, "Sure, go ahead." And she goes. And now she tells the servant as they're going, "Hey, just run and keep running as fast as you can until I tell you to slow down." So she wants to get there. She's booking it. We're talking about 15 miles is about the distance if she's going to Megiddo or to Carmel. Now, both places, Dothan and Carmel, are on a hill. And so if she had been a regular attendant to the Sabbath or those kind of things, who would have seen her coming from a distance on a regular basis? Elisha, right? You know, you get to know people. You can see them at a distance. And in this situation, Elisha sees her coming and says, "Something's up." She normally doesn't run on her way in, okay? This is not the right time of the year for her to be here. Something's up. He sends a servant out there to ask her, "Is everything all right with you, with the family, with the son?" She's like, it's fine. And she doesn't grieve, doesn't want to say anything until she gets to Elisha. It's at Elisha's feet that she breaks down. At least we see that in the text. It's at Elisha's feet that she finally says, "This is what's going to happen. This is what I need from you." And what does Elisha say when she falls down at her feet? Gehazi kind of wants to kind of push her away because it's obvious that this is not normal. You're not supposed to approach a man of God this way. But what does Elisha say? "Leave her alone. There's something going on. Let her alone, for her soul is troubled within her. The Lord's hidden from me what's going on." It's this point. It was only Elisha that she was going to weep in front of. As far as we know, it's only at Elisha's feet, somebody who could do something about it, that she says this. And she said, "Did I ask for a son? I didn't ask for this, and you gave it to me. You gave me a child, and he died. I didn't ask for this grief. I didn't ask for the possibility of this happening, and you gave me this child." And so it's probably taken time. The way the text reads, it probably took some time for her to gather her composure to finally say this to this prophet. This is probably what she's been wanting to say the whole time getting down to him. And so Elisha sends Gehazi off with his staff and says, "Hey, don't stop, don't do anything, just go lay the staff on the child." And she says, and he kind of tries to send her on her way, and she says, "I'm not leaving without you. I came here to find you. You are going with me. You are making a house call." So they go. Obviously, Gehazi is running ahead of them. They get there. It didn't work. And so Elisha goes up into the room, lays himself on the body of the child, which is similar to what Elijah had done as well, mouth to mouth, eyes to eyes, and almost like the text reads, the body warms up when he's doing this. And then he gets up and prays again after he already prayed to the Lord once, and then does this again, and the body, the boy comes alive and sneezes seven times. As though, you know, the body had not been breathing and kind of sneezes life back into him. And what's interesting, in verse 36, after this happened, in verse 36, he called Gehazi and said, "Call the Shunammite." again, she has a name, Elisha. She never called this Shunammite. And she comes in and he says, take up your son. What does she do? What would you have done? What would you have done? Your child that was dead is now alive. The person that tells you to heal this your son or child says, go take up your child. Would you have needed that command? Would you have needed that command to go and lift up your child that's now alive? What's that? Yeah, what did she do? She didn't go right to the child. She went and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground, and she took up her son and went out. That is significant. It is significant that she went and thanked him first. In essence, thanking the Lord for what he had done before going up and taking the blessing again that God had given her. That is significant. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. 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 Exactly. Yep. Yep. Exactly. And that's what she's saying. She literally says shalom. Is what she says. Literally says shalom, peace. It's okay. It's kind of like, you know, when somebody comes in and asks you how you're doing, you're like, that's fine. Is it really fine? We don't just tell what really we have inside to everybody. She knew Elisha could do something about it, but these other people necessarily wouldn't be able to. Yes, ma'am. It's probably Ruth. Okay, yes. Yes, probably Ruth is her name. Yes. So yes, very good traits, this individual. So, in this case, the boy, the child is healed, and then we move on to, some poisonous stew. Now this is an interesting story. Elisha returned, to Gilgal, and there was a famine in the land, which, you know, happened from time to time. And the sons of the prophets were sitting before him and said to his servant, put on a large pot and boil stew for the sons of prophets. And then one went out into the field and gathered herbs. Now, as you read this story, I kind of have in the back of my mind that these are guys that aren't cooking on a regular basis. At least one of them isn't. Because look what happens. One goes out into the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered from it in his lap full of gourds. Have you ever like folded over like a long shirt or something like that, or folded over whatever you're wearing to gather up berries or something like that? That's kind of what this person is doing with these gourds, and brings them in and cuts them up and puts them into the stew. Then as they're sitting there eating, so they poured out it out for the men to eat, and as they were eating of the stew, they cried out and said, "O man of God, there is death in the pot. There's death in the pot." What's interesting is that they've kind of surmised that maybe this is it's called a Citrullus corinthus, which basically looks like, I have a picture of it. I forgot to put this on here. Just for you guys, I Googled it. That's a picture of what it probably was. It looks like what? Looks like small watermelons, right? I mean, hey, that's going to go in a stew. But you know what? If you boil this into a stew, you know what happens? It's an extreme form of, it's an extreme laxative, to the point of bleeding, extreme laxative. They also use this to perform abortions and things of that nature when women were pregnant. So somebody eats this and has that whoop. There's death in the pot. So you can imagine what happens, how they ascertain the situation's going, what they find themselves in at this point. And what does Elisha do? Bring me some meal, and he kind of sprinkles it in some flour, and so it's good. The meal may have been symbolic, which a lot of things were with the prophets. God, all he would have to do is pray to God for the nourishment of our body, right? Because that's what we do. And it would have been fine, but maybe the meal was symbolic but this pot was cleansed, and there was no harm in the pot. And then we have the feeding of possibly 100 people, verse 42 through 44. There came a man from a certain city and brought the man of God first fruits of every loaves of barley and the ears of grain in a sack. And he said, "Give them to the people that they may eat." And his attendant said, "Wait, will I set this before 100 men?" As though to say it was not enough. This is not sufficient amount of food for those who are sitting here. But he said, "Give them to people that they may eat. For thus says the Lord, they shall eat and have some left over." So he set it before them, and they ate and had some left over according to the word of the Lord. I don't know if they had 12 baskets full, but they had some left over. All right, it was very similar. What's interesting is you read these things that Elisha's doing, the things that Elijah had done, and when you read in the New Testament, when Jesus asks, "Who do men say that the Son of Man is? Who do men say that I am?" And some of them said Elijah. Are we seeing why they would have thought that? The things that they were, the prophets, he was a great prophet. These are very similar events that unfolded there. Now, chapter 5, probably a more famous passage in 2 Kings. Good old Naaman. Who is Naaman? If you read the first few verses of chapter 5, who is this guy? He's not just whoever, right? He's the commander of an army of Aram. Which, by the way, who are these Arameans? We've had dealings with them before. The king that Naaman is serving is Ben-Hadad. They fought against this guy already. They're not like really good friends. And there's some other reasons why we know they're not really good friends, even in this text. We know that he was a valiant warrior. We know that the Lord gave him victory, probably over the Assyrians, is who the Lord gave them victory over. And but how do we know from this text in verse 2 specifically, that, you know, they're not exactly best of friends, the Armenians and Israel? What does it say? Verse 2. They went out on raids and brought back captive a young slave girl. So we're not going to get through as much as I had planned on. So we know that they're not on good terms. And what's interesting is this slave girl knows that Naaman is a leper. And what does she wish for her master? Healing. You know, she wants him to be healed. So apparently there is at least some copacetic relationship, psychologically speaking. There could have been, you know, other things going on. What is it called when you're Stockholm, maybe? But in this situation, she wants her master to be healed. And what does she say? Here's a child. This is a child. Here's a voice of faith from a child. And the child says, "There's a prophet in Israel that could heal you. Take care of this. This is not an issue." And so apparently, finally, Naaman gets word through some of the other servants that this child had said thus and such about it, and it was at least legitimate enough for Naaman to take this into consideration. He went to the king, and the king of Aram, which is probably Ben-Hadad, said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." And he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothes. In today's currency, that silver is $165,000. That gold is $2,643,300. Just to give you, you know, pocket change, right? Pocket change. So that's how much he's taking with him to go. And verse 6 was interesting. He brought the letter to king of Israel, which is probably Jehoram, and said, "Now, as a letter comes to you, behold, I have sent Naaman, my servant." This is what Ben-Hadad is saying to the king, "that you may cure him of his leprosy." What's interesting here is that the text does not give us the name of the king. So the king is not important. The king is irrelevant, who the king is. Who's the focus in this? Naaman and Elisha. Really, God is, but the king is irrelevant. But how does the king respond to this? He makes it about himself, doesn't he? He makes this about himself. He said, what am I? Am I going to heal this guy? Am I the person that's going to be able to do this? He said, am I a God to kill, to make alive, that this man is sending a word to cure a man of leprosy? And he's thinking, well, hey, this is a tactic Ben-Hadad. I'm not going to be able to heal this guy. And Ben-Hadad's going to come attack me because I couldn't heal his commander. And then Elisha finally hears about it. And what's Elisha's response in verse 8? Why are you tearing your clothes, dude? Why are you getting all worked up about this? Just send it to me. The point is, he says, that he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. That's what he wants. That's what he wants him to learn. Hold on to that thought. We'll come back to it. And so they send a messenger to him. So Naaman comes to... Okay, this scene, I don't know. Do you guys watch Westerns at all or have seen or heard about Westerns? Okay, spaghetti Westerns. Anybody into spaghetti Westerns? Okay, the Clint Eastwood, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, those kind of things. Okay, dusty place. All right, imagine this scene. A dusty place, little adobe hut, okay, where Elisha is. Naaman and all his entourage comes up, and the horses, you can hear them, like the crunching on the rocks and stuff. And they call out to Elisha to come out, and there's silence. Nothing. Exactly. And then a screeching door opens, and this little servant kind of shuffles out, walks up to Naaman, and kind of tells him, hey, you need to go just bathe, dip in the River Jordan 7 times, turns around and goes back into the hut and shuts the door. In my mind, that's what happened. It was so not a big deal. But how does Naaman respond to this that unfolded before him? What's his response? Hey, wait a second. Behold, I thought. I mean, that's his catch line, right? That's what everybody knows him as. Behold, I thought. Here's the voice of expectation. Here's what I thought was supposed to happen. There was supposed to be a big song and dance. I'm an important person. This is a big deal to me. You're supposed to come out and do it this way and make it and wave your hand just like this. And then I was going to be healed and I was going to give this money and I was going to walk away. Huh? And that's what was supposed to happen. But it didn't happen like that at all. So much so that it's almost as if Elisha's trying to show him that for God, leprosy is no big deal. We take care of that like, you know, it's, you know, a common flu or a common cold. Not a big deal. You know, God just takes care of that. But behold, I thought there's an expectation. And how does he respond? He goes away angry, right? Goes away angry. This is what I thought was supposed to happen. He leaves angry. And almost misses out on being healed, almost misses out on this blessing if it wasn't for who? Another servant. The voice of reason, right? Here comes a servant and says, hey, you know what? If he had asked you to go to some far-off land, kill a dragon, cut its tooth out, bring it back, and make a potion for... If he had asked you to do some great thing, you would have done it. You would have done that. And all he's asking you to do is to go dip in the river 7 times. You can't argue with that logic, can you? You can't argue with it. So he does. He goes and finally submits to the commands of God, and he does this thing, and when he submits to the commands of God, he receives the blessing. Is there a life lesson there at all? Possibly. How many people have kept themselves from the blessings of God because they're not willing to submit to His commands? Millions, billions have kept themselves from the blessings of God because they have not submitted to His simple ordinance of do it this way because they think too much, right? We think too much sometimes. Just do what it says. Well, the Bible says this, but I don't know what that means. It means that. It doesn't mean anything else. It means that. In this case, it means go dip in the river 7 times. And he finally does that. He washes and is renewed, not just cleaned. It didn't just come off. Instead, it had skin like a small child, right? I mean, this is he has completely new skin. And so he goes back to pay for this. And what is his response in verse 15? After this happens, what is his response? He says, behold again. Which apparently that's like you got to say behold. What does he say?
When
Behold, now I know there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Was this a lesson he needed to learn? Exactly. This was a lesson he needed to learn. Sometimes a lesson we need to remember, and the others need to learn as well. And he tries to pay for it, and he says, and Elisha says, I'm not going to take anything. If you want to write out there Matthew 10:8, freely you have received, freely you give, Matthew 10:8. And it was common in that time for pagans to pay the oracles for their messages and things like that. And he says, well, if I'm not going to be able to pay you anything, can I take some dirt with me? Sure. We've got tons, right? So he says, I want 2 mules of dirt to basically make an altar on. And he says, I want to serve Jehovah God. I want to serve Jehovah and make my offerings to him and nobody else. And then he says, but I have to go in with the king. Here's something else he asked for pardon. He said, I have to go in to the house of Rimmon to worship there. And because the king goes with, I take the king and the king leans on my shoulder. Please ask for forgiveness for this thing. It's as if he's saying, I have to go in there. I know it's not valid. I know it's not where I should be, but I have to go because it's my service. I have to, that's my job to go do this. And he says, go in peace, is what he tells him. He asks for pardon in that matter. And he says, go in peace. So he doesn't receive any of this money. But then Gehazi begins thinking, right? That gets you in trouble, thinking. And he says, behold, my master has spared this Naaman, the Aramean, by not receiving the hand. So here's a guy who has punished us, who has raided us, who's rung the bell way too early, and he's done all these evil things against us, and we're going to let him go scot-free without paying anything? No. We got to get something out of him. And so he goes up to him, runs after him, we'll finish with this, and, you know, they see this guy running after him, and eventually he stops this chariot, gets down off the chariot to address him, which apparently in that time was a sign of respect. You wouldn't do, like, an important person would not get off their chariot for anybody. He does that for Gehazi because of who Elisha is, not because of who the servant is. And he lies and says, you know, these two guys showed up. We need a talent of silver and 2 changes of clothes for each of them. And so he lied about that. And then he finally goes and takes it, hides it. The servants who were carrying it with him carried it until they got to the hill where the city was and said, oh, you guys go. Leave. I'll take this. Apparently hides it in the house. And he goes in to Elisha. And Elisha says, what? Where were you? Now, how many of you, after coming in somewhere to the house and parents ask, where were you? Do you ever think they might know before I even answer? Which in this case, Elisha knew the answer. And he says, oh, you know, I wasn't anywhere, is what he says, basically. You know, oh, me, you know me, I'll just go out. He said, I wasn't anywhere. Your servant went nowhere. Liar, liar, pants on fire. And he says to him, did you not know that I went with you? My heart went with you. I knew what happened when you went. And he tells him exactly what happened to the chariot. And he says, this is not a time for money. Apparently, his heart was set on money. And so maybe he reads to him his heart's concern or his heart's desires for these things listed here, for clothes, for vineyards, for sheep, for servants and that kind of stuff. He says, now what? The leprosy that was on Naaman is now on you. And he went out white from leprosy. And now he's an outcast. Now he's an outcast. Where he was somebody who was servant to Elisha, and now he's an outcast. He can be around no man. He loses everything over this lie and focusing on riches instead of what he should have been focused on. Yes. So this was something that was going to be perpetually passed on through this guy. As if it was a reminder to those around that you don't mess around with the things that God has said. And so this was something that was perpetually passed down. So it was a very, very poignant lesson, a hard way to learn that lesson. Any questions, comments before we close? Yes, sir. Yes. Yes, there's a lot of thinking here is, like, you know, there's a lot of misinformation, like you're saying, and not communicating clearly. Hey, go tell them, I just need to get healed by this prophet you guys got here, instead of making a big deal out of it, and then thinking too much about what wasn't said, right? That's very true. Just see the information for what it is. Don't read an agenda into it, right? Exactly. All right, thank you very much for your time tonight. I appreciate it.